Well, first, it strikes me that this man is in his 90s and he's able to convey such a speech in such an audience. I think is I'm always sort of stunned by that with Mugabe. But in terms of the substance of the speech, you know, there were some quite positive things I was pleased to hear. As a Pan-Africanist, some of the language on Western Sahara, for example, as an internationalist, the language on Palestine and support for Palestine. But clearly, you know, in terms of the substance of the speech, the thrust around global governance and changes that are so desperately needed for the UN Security Council to be much more democratic, much more open, particularly with Africa having greater representation in terms of a permanent seat on the Security Council. Mm-hmm. I think some of the substance of the speech were right on point.
Obviously, he was also speaking on behalf of the African Union body of which he's chairing right now. What did you make of the quote-unquote self-anointed prefix of our time who seemed to be, in his words, dictating Africa's course?
Well, I think what he's pushing is for the African Union to be much more in control, recognizing that the African Union is a partner of the United Nations. Putting that in the speech, I thought was really extraordinary and important. I think the line about Libya and linked to the migrants and the flow of refugees from the continent, but the importance of the African Union having been neglected in terms of decision making on foreign intervention in Libya, I think was an extraordinary and a point. Right on target, because it speaks to not only the issues that we see unfolding today, Libya and this outflow of humanity, really, people trying desperately to find a different path and a better way of life, but recognizing the centrality of the African Union. The African Union had a different approach in terms of Libya, mm-hmm. and I think, you know, Mugabe in the speech skillfully not only asserted the importance of the African Union and its relationship to the United Nations, but also, you know, had a case in point in mm-hmm. terms of an example where the African Union's path and the African Union's decision was completely sort of sidelined mm-hmm. As other countries, the U.S. and Europe, essentially went forward in doing what it did in Libya, the foreign intervention in Libya, and the consequences thereafter have been so dire, not only for Libya and the region, but for the world. So I think he was able to make the case in a very kind of clear and deliberate fashion, and that was right on point.
Now, speaking about Libya, just going off President Mugabe for a second, turning to President Obama in the comments he made about Libya, he almost sounded contrite from part of what he mentioned about how they're going to use Libya as a lesson in terms of what not to do in other countries going forward. What did you make of that?
I thought it was, you know, right and absolutely justified, but too little too late. Right? I think that's the problem. I think many see the actions of the U.S., irrespective of Obama, as being very much putting forward a militarized approach to foreign policy. And I think the concern was that the U.S. and NATO went in, the U.S. With Africa, its Africa Command, and essentially intervened in Libya, using drones, using bombs, using whatever tools at their disposal, but essentially have created havoc in Libya. And so to hear the President of the United States say, you know, we're going to learn our lessons, it's good to hear, but I think we still have to see how that will play out in time. Because clearly what we see happening before us today is yet another foreign intervention with Britain going in now to Somalia, I think the worry is that the lessons of military leading foreign policy decision making, those lessons really have not been learned, and so we're still, unfortunately, in spite of the words of Obama and the UN, we're still concerned that foreign military intervention is still the order of the day, in spite of the disastrous consequences cases like Libya have proven.
Now, there are several occasions where President Mugabe went off script and plugged in a few words here and there, and one of them had to do with the Middle East, where he says the suffering of the Palestinian people continues unabated, and then he plugged in, what does Mr. Obama say about that? And then he also added another point where he says, do we agree with the United States on that, when he was referring to the unwavering support to the just cause of the Palestinian people? What comes to your mind?
Well, I applaud the speech of Mugabe in supporting and standing in solidarity with the Palestinian people. I think the U.S. has been duplicitous in terms of its role in undermining the cause for justice, human rights, and dignity in Palestine. And so I think that was one where President Mugabe actually had it right in terms of calling the U.S. to task for actions not being in line with the rhetoric of support for human rights and human dignity.
Moving now specifically to the Zimbabwe-related issues, of course, President Mugabe, first of all, painted a very overall Africa perspective and raised the issues of concern to the general continent. But then he did get very specific when it came to Zimbabwe. And of course, predictably, the issue of what he terms illegal sanctions. And he actually kind of appealed to the United States and the European Union to explain what has Zimbabwe done so wrong to be subjected to these kind of sanctions. With what you know about sanctions and what President Mugabe is saying now in the U.S. position on it, do you see any justification at this point still for the U.S.? And do you see any impact of President Mugabe's call for them to be dropped?
Well, I don't really see a justification in terms of the U.S. maintaining the sanctions. I mean, I think clearly there were commitments made back with the Lancaster Agreement for funding, both from U.S. and from Europe, to help on issues like land reform and land redistribution and the like. And so what you have, in fact, is really a tool that Mugabe can pull out of his toolkit at any time in terms of bashing the West. You know, and so I think in the context in which sanctions in terms of Iran have moved in a much more positive direction, I think it is also time to consider the U.S. Approach in terms of Zimbabwe and whether or not it has brought the outcome that was desired. I think if the U.S. is able to advance in negotiations with Iran to the extent that they have, then I think it is long overdue to also examine the U.S. Strategy mm-hmm. with regards to sanctions and Zimbabwe. And I think eliminating opportunities where presidents like Mugabe can pull out this one item, I think would be helpful in terms of carrying a conversation forward in a different direction.
But some can also argue that, well, in support of the U.S., that it contends that the reforms that it has requested Zimbabwe to implement have not completely been carried out. And even as President Mugabe is talking about the Sahrawi people, there are some also say, well, in Zimbabwe, there's a missing person by the name of Itai Dzamara, who Absolutely. No one seems to be talking about. So in light of that reality that some are still looking at Zimbabwe as having human rights issues and the U.S.'s stance to maintain its sanctions, does that kind of offer any other kind of insight from the
U.S.? I think absolutely right on point in terms of thinking about especially the journalists that have been wrongly imprisoned and their rights completely denied. You know, I think holding up the need for protecting the rights of people, whether it's civil society or the media, and human rights activists and human rights defenders of all kinds and stripes should be protected, must be protected around the world, not only in Zimbabwe, but clearly that's an issue that remains. Now sanctions aren't used in every instance in which human rights are being denied, and so I think it is looking at this question of sanctions and the extent to which they are relevant in the case of Zimbabwe. Mm-hmm. Clearly we have had historic examples. The anti-apartheid examples are probably the most stark, in which sanctions were rightfully applied and maintained in a way that had a desired impact, the fall of the apartheid regime and the end of the political process, at any rate, of apartheid. I think what we have to do in the case of Zimbabwe from the perspective of U.S. foreign policy is to examine the extent to which the sanctions are still valid and the extent to which they are having an impact that's desirable. Clearly, the Zimbabwean economy is in a state where support for engagement may bring a better result in terms of the Zimbabwean people. And so I think it is time to keep an eye on whether or not the strategy of sanctions in terms of Zimbabwe has actually passed its time.
Would it be in the United States' interest to drop the sanctions? Because President Mugabe seems to be extending an olive branch, but the question is, what would the U.S. want out of Zimbabwe for it to heed the call?
Well, I think, you know, the U.S., particularly U.S. private sector, is constantly having an eye to Zimbabwe and Zimbabwe's particularly extractive resources. And so, I think there's always interest in terms of the U.S. private sector in terms of further engagement, one, but also in terms of countering China. I think that has been, for many in the U.S. private sector, a longstanding interest, countering China's role in not just Zimbabwe, but throughout the African continent. And so I think there's always interest. The question is to what extent now the Obama administration is coming to an end of its tenure, as its term, to what extent there is the appetite to engage in a foreign policy shift, the extent to which was needed to bring about a change in strategy in Cuba and elsewhere, to what extent there is the appetite to do that in the Obama administration now regarding Zimbabwe, I think it's still unknown.
President Mugabe raised the point on the issue of homosexuality, gays, in his words. And the question that he poses, that we, or rather the statement, that we equally reject attempts to prescribe new rights. And that's another thing that he injected in the script that was not part of the original script: we are not gays. What is the responsibility that you think the United Nations has to calls by a leader like President Mugabe to say, or the accusations that you're imposing upon us, uncultural practices like homosexuality?
You know, I think the United Nations stands to protect and defend human rights and human dignity and the rights of all on this planet. You know, it's kind of enshrined in the UN Declaration of Human Rights. And so I think regardless of sexual orientation, those rights are and have been protected by the UN Declaration of Human Rights. And so I think it is it's unfortunate, you know, that President Mugabe chose that platform for this rant. Unfortunate that it has garnered so much attention, and I think it's negative attention, not just for Zimbabwe, but for the continent. Clearly, the continent is moving in a direction where the rights of all, regardless of sexual orientation, can and must be protected and respected. And so I think, you know, when we acknowledge, for example, the South African Constitution, which is far above and beyond all constitutions in the world in terms of protecting the rights of minorities, particularly those of dependent, regardless of their sexual orientation, I think we've got to uphold those examples on the continent now in this 21st century and really you know, downplay the attention to rants like that of Mugabe at the UN.
But at the same time, he got a lot of applause. There was a long pause between that statement and the next sentence that he was going to start, meaning that there's a lot of consensus, at least among the African leaders and the, maybe many from other countries as well, who actually agree with him.
You know, I think it's nervous. It sounded to me more like sort of nervousness in terms of the reaction and the response and you know, a sense of, oh, did he really say that? You know, so it's not only that the media focuses on it, but how people reacted also was a bit sort of in dismay, you know. So I would want to emphasize more a UN, you know, regardless of how the reactions in terms of the Mugabe speech, and, you know, a UN that goes to and is driven by its principles, the principles that are enshrined in the Declaration, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and the principles that are upheld by UN agencies as they do their work around the world. I think it is that which we should take as a guide, and really not the others.
Final question has to do with what is your take on the substance of the discussions at the United Nations General Assembly and what happens thereafter? I mean, speaker after speaker, there was this call for unity, this call to really back each other up as they try to really implement the 17 new goals under the Sustainable Development Goals. And yet you hear such division sometimes when you hear from the leaders about what they believe is a unified effort or not.
Right. I think, you know, we come at these moments where, you know, the UN was gathered for sort of a launch of the Sustainable Development Goals. We come to these moments where the international community really has to come to terms with where we are as a global economy. The majority of people on the planet are really in dire straits, you know, whether you call it the 99%, you know, but those that have done quite well, continue to do well, and those that don't have are facing increasingly dire circumstances. And so, you know, so the goals are meant to address this growing inequality and to address the issues of impoverishment of communities, even communities that are rich in resources. So I think it's important for the UN to carve out these spaces. I think the attention on things like climate change, moving towards a UN conference on climate change in December, and the focus of that this week in the meetings in New York, I think is also right on point. But it will take more than speeches. It will take commitments backed by resources. Some will say it will take a new global economy that it moves away from a more capitalist economy towards an economy that works for all before we're able to actually achieve human dignity and live lives of dignity around the world. So I think, you know, I would want to applaud those at the UN for their efforts, but to continue to push, because it will be far more than the speeches this week that will bring changes to people's lives around the continent, around the world.
Somebody asked a question about, well, if the 8 MDG goals, Millennium Development Goals, were not as successfully implemented, what hope can one place in the 17 goals under the Sustainable Development Goals? Are you optimistic about their implementation over the lack of implementation of all the 8 MDG goals?
Well, I think that's a great question. I think the issue is, you know, the world has to set for itself goals that are defined and with a clear timetable and a financing mechanism. And, you know, but in essence, the Millennium Development Goals were designed to cut poverty in half, really. And the Sustainable Development Goals will still, you know, move in the direction of cutting poverty in half, but you will still have half the planet left in dire circumstances. So the goals are a beginning point, whether the Millennium Development Goals or now the Sustainable Development Goals, but much more is needed to bring about the structural changes that will bring an economy that works for all, that will bring environmental protection in the wake of climate change in a way that meets the needs of all on this planet. So I see it as, starting measures important, but much more will be needed to actually bring a future for people and the planet that is with dignity.